From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and coming up, a debate over gentrification. Some San Francisco residents are angry that the tech boom is forcing longtime residents out of their homes.
But we start with that search for hundreds of people still missing after that ferry capsized off the coast of South Korea today. Many of the missing, high school students on a school trip to a vacation island. More than 150 people were rescued by helicopter and boat, but even as they were being picked up, the huge ferry was sinking beneath them. Here are survivors speaking to the BBC.
There was an announcement telling us to sit still, but the ferry was already sinking. Some of the students were not able to escape.
It was very tense. The ship was tilted more than 45 degrees, and it was very tense.
The BBC's World Affairs correspondent Nick Childs is monitoring the story from London. And Nick, tell us more about this ferry, because it appears to us more like a what we'd call a cruise ship.
Robin, it's a passenger ferry, I suppose you could say, about 6,000 tons. It does a regular voyage from the northwest of South Korea to this resort island. The reports were that a distress signal was issued just off the southwest coast of South Korea just after 9 o'clock in the morning local time. Rescuers were on the scene pretty quickly, but the ship was already lurching and listing at a very crazy angle. But there were dramatic scenes of helicopters hoisting passengers off the ship, and a swarm of small boats also plucking people out of the cold water. But there were more than 400 people on board, and as you say, a large number remain unaccounted for.
Do we know why this has happened? This is a sophisticated country. It appears to be, as you said, a regular ship line and a sophisticated ship that had a shopping mall and a food court on it. Do we have any idea why this happened?
That's the puzzle at the moment. Part of the anger that has been added to the anxiety, particularly of the parents on board, is that initially there was, first of all, confusion as to how many people had been rescued and how many had survived. Initially, the authorities said most had been rescued, and then dramatically they changed the story and said actually a significant number, including many of these high school students, remained unaccounted for. But the reports one heard initially were people talking of a thud, a bump, an impact, and then the ship started to list. There were reports also of heavy fog, which some have said may have contributed to the disaster in some way, and yet the Coast Guard apparently says visibility was pretty good at the time, and actually the sea also was pretty calm. So it still remains a mystery, and clearly one of the questions to be answered, but the priority for now at least must be trying to find out what's happened to those missing.
Well, it's frigid water. What is the sense of how long someone could survive if they... It's one thing to be trapped in the ship, but if they went into the water.
Well, that's the great concern, and obviously it's dark there now, so that complicates the problem of the search, if you like. It is just possible, I suppose, to hold out a glimmer of hope that because there was a real swarm of small boats taking part in the rescue, as well as helicopters, that once they tot up all those that have been brought ashore, that the figures may change again. But there must be concern that survivability in those cold waters must be pretty slim by now. And also, the ship rolled over completely and was completely submerged as far as any hope of getting into the vessel itself was concerned. There may be hope that some people may be trapped in air pockets within the ship, but given the state of the vessel at the moment, there must be concerns that those chances are pretty slim also. But a large number of divers are now part of that rescue effort, so they will be working hard on that.
Mm. Well, these were 16 and 17-year-olds from the Danwon High School in Ansan City near Seoul. There have been other disasters in South Korea. In 1993, 292 died when a ferry sank. In 1970, 323 drowned when another ferry sank. This has to be just really reverberating in South Korea.
Yes, we've already had the South Korean president talking about this being a truly tragic event because of the presence of the students aboard, and the passenger line company has also said it was sorry through an official because of the number of students involved in this.
Yeah. BBC's World Affairs correspondent Nick Childs. Nick, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, here in this country, the Commerce Department said today that groundbreaking on new homes rose less than expected last month. Perhaps another sign that the housing market is starting to slow down thanks to higher mortgage rates and higher home prices. But in some parts of the country, a slowdown in housing prices may be welcomed. Places like San Francisco, where rents are among the highest in the country, there has been a record number of evictions in the last year. Some landlords have been using a California law known as the Ellis Act, which allows them to say they're going out of business in order to sell or convert what are sometimes rent-controlled buildings. But is this just one of the ugly side effects of an improving economy? Joining us now from KQED in San Francisco are Aaron McElroy of the group Eviction Free San Francisco and also Greg Gretsch, managing director at the tech venture capital firm Sigma West. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Aaron, let's just talk about what you see as the problem first. You've helped to organize some of these Google bus protests, and you've started this mapping project. Tell us what exactly is going on in San Francisco that you've got a problem with.
Sure. So ultimately, I have a problem with the eviction epidemic that is ongoing in San Francisco currently and across the Bay Area for that matter. What we're seeing is a lot of longtime residents be displaced and a political economy ensue in which a lot of people are moving here to work in the tech industry, driving up rents and then leading to a situation in which speculators and realtors can evict tenants, flip buildings, and create housing that people that are more upwardly mobile can afford to live in.
Well, and give us the numbers that you're looking at, because I know you've got data on this.
For sure. So there are three kinds of no-fault evictions that we're specifically worried about: Ellis Act evictions, owner move-in evictions, and demolitions. And all of those evictions happen when tenants, for no fault of their own, are evicted. Ellis Act evictions are up 175% over the last 12 months alone. And Ellis Act evictions are what we consider the most insidious type of eviction. It's the type of eviction being most abused by speculators and investors.
And the Ellis Act, we've got more information on that at our website, hereandnow.org. That's a California law. Aaron, what do you see as the reason for all this, though, behind all of these evictions? Because hearing it from the outside, it sounds like exactly the same story that we're seeing in Washington, D.C., and New York and Boston and other cities, which is economy booming. People want to make more money on their units, and so they're kicking people out that aren't paying the highest possible rent.
Yeah, I mean, that's it in a nutshell, and that is what we have a problem with. We see it being both resultant of the real estate industry and what we were calling a sort of trifecta, if you will, between the tech industry, the real estate industry, and city and state government, in which tech is being privileged and longtime residents not in tech are being economically abandoned, if you will.
Let me bring in Greg Gretsch. Can you respond to that and what we've heard there? What do you think about that when you hear that argument about what's happening to people in San Francisco and these evictions, but also the reason behind it being this tech industry that's booming, essentially?
Well, I think first take a step back and talk about the economy in San Francisco. The economy in San Francisco right now is benefiting absolutely from a tremendous economic boom. Just looking at 2013, there were almost 27,000 new jobs created in San Francisco, and only 8,000 of those jobs were tech jobs. San Francisco doesn't have a tech problem. San Francisco has a housing problem, and San Francisco has long had a housing problem. It's a desirable place to live, but San Francisco is geographically limited. We have water on three sides, and so San Francisco can't build out, but San Francisco should build up. And for generations, San Francisco has fought building up. And our issue now is just a lack of housing stock. And that can only be fixed over the long term by adding more housing stock.
But it's not going to build up right away. You're not going to have 40 and 50 story buildings show up within the amount of time that some people are hoping, which is, you know, I'm getting evicted next week. I need a place to stay. So what's the solution right now?
No, and you're absolutely right. And the mayor has put forth a plan to put 30,000 new housing units into the city by 2020. And the mayor and the tech community in the form of SF City has gotten behind Senator Leno's SB 1439, which would be Ellis Act reform, to close some of the loopholes and protect long-term tenants in the Ellis Act. So, you know, the economic boom does create some issues. And, you know, I think part of being in tech, you realize that in any tech company, you make advances and those advances cause challenges. Do you stop the advances because of the challenges? No, you go back and try to fix the challenges.
Aaron McElroy, do you think that affordable housing and more affordable housing is going to solve this problem? Because it's, of course, not just people who are being evicted. There are also people who just don't want to live in an apartment where the rent keeps going up and end up moving out on their own volition.
Well, certainly I hope that when and if housing is built, that it be built affordably. Unfortunately, right now, affordable housing is housing built for people who are making under $150,000 a year. The average median income per capita in San Francisco is $46,000. So if you're a poor working class or even middle class, most likely you can't compete for even affordable housing at this point. But first and foremost, we want to see the affordable housing that exists, namely in the form of rent control, be preserved. Every time an Ellis Act eviction is enacted and then the unit eventually condoizes, we lose rent control. And rent control is a non-renewable resource, if you will, in San Francisco. It only applies to non-single family homes built prior to 1979. So, you know, for instance, a friend of mine who is 98, her year came up and she is now being forced out of her home. She will eventually probably be dragged out by the sheriffs. She has a partial Alzheimer's and does not even fully recognize that she is being evicted because it's so unfathomable to her. Another friend of mine, Benito Santiago, is currently being evicted. He's also a senior disabled man, Filipino, born and raised in San Francisco, and teaches in the Unified School District, which means that a lot of people are, of course, leaving the city altogether or are living out of cars in on their friends' couches or are being made homeless.
So some very difficult situations there, although some people may hear this and think, well, when the economy grows, housing prices are going to go up. Not everyone will necessarily be able to afford to continue to live in the same place that they did before. We're speaking with Aaron McElroy of Eviction Free San Francisco and Greg Gretsch of the venture capital firm Sigma West. We welcome your comments about this at hereandnow.org. Stay with us. More to come here and now. This is Here and Now, and we're looking today at how the tech boom in San Francisco is affecting the city and some of its longtime residents. Rents there are very high, and evictions have risen by 115% over the last year, according to the Anti-Eviction Mapping Project, and it's created a lot of tension. There have been protests in front of those private Google buses that take Google employees from San Francisco down to Silicon Valley. We're talking with Greg Gretsch, managing director at the tech venture capital firm Sigma West, and Aaron McElroy of the group Eviction Free San Francisco. And Aaron, it's hard not to feel sympathy for those who are evicted, but are you against the economic growth? Because how do you get around the fact that when the economy grows, housing is going to become more expensive and certain people are going to lose out in that equation?
You know, I would be pro the economy growing, and I am, of course, pro the economy growing if, in fact, trickle-down economics worked and if we had evidence of it working. I can tell you that on the ground, nobody is seeing it actually manifest in any sort of working nature. Basically, people who have long-time businesses are being kicked out of their homes, are unable to continue working in their businesses. People are also not having their businesses frequented by people who are moving into the city now to work in tech. There are less laundromats in the Mission, for instance, than ever before. People who own laundromats for a very long time are losing their jobs because folks in tech are, you know, able to have their laundry washed by the companies that they work for. My friend Mia Gonzalez had a shop on Valencia Street that went out of business recently. She can't find another way to support herself in the city and is being forced to leave. And, you know, San Francisco historically has had no problem with newcomers. It's actually been very hospitable towards newcomers, whether you are moving here to escape political oppression in the global south, whether you are moving here because you are looking for a trans health clinic, maybe you're moving here because San Francisco has some of the best AIDS doctors in the country. But it's long been a place that people have moved to who are marginal, who are in some way societally or socially oppressed. It hasn't been historically a place to move to make money. Obviously, that happened during the dot-com boom, and then that petered out, and now we're seeing it happen now exponentially at a sort of hyper rate.
But couldn't you just move to one of the less expensive suburbs, for example?
Yeah, you know, if you're 98 and if you have an entire social support system that you've developed for, you know, 98 years, if you're reliant on your neighbor to help you out, if you know the person who works at the local corner store who can get you what you need, if for instance, maybe you can't communicate that day. You can't just pack up your bags and, you know, move to West Oakland and enact a whole new cycle of gentrification there. It's a lot easier for somebody probably my age to do that than it is for the people that are disproportionately being evicted right now.
Greg Gretsch, you come from a very different perspective on this. Tell us what you think of what you've just heard there.
Well, you know, first off, you know, I wouldn't say I come from a different perspective. I think the dislocation that's caused, you can't help but feel empathy for the people who are feeling this dislocation. But when you look at the aggregate statistics for San Francisco and the economy in San Francisco, it has been a, you know, rising tide has lifted pretty much all boats. Inflation in the city between 2010 and 2012 was 2.6%, while wages increased by 4.5%. You know, through the rest of the country, you talk about wage increases not keeping up with the rate of inflation. And here in San Francisco, we're seeing the exact opposite, where wages are increasing at greater than the rate of inflation. The city budget also, you know, one of the nice things about the economic boom is it fills the city coffers. And for a lot of the people that are dislocated through this, their only source of help is going to be through government programs in the city. And, you know, in 2008, the city was suffering with a $500 million budget deficit. And this year, the budget grew 10% from last year, and there is no budget deficit at all. So the city is booming on many levels. And the extra resources that the city has as a result of this economic boom are being used to try and help solve some of the issues that are caused by it.
Well, one of the big flashpoints here has been, as we mentioned earlier, the Google bus and transit. And I want to ask you both about that. If you can't build adequate, affordable housing quickly enough, at least you can provide people a quick way to get into their jobs in the city at a reasonable price on public transit. But San Francisco and other cities around the country that are dealing with this kind of very quick gentrification, it's not as if they have dramatically increased their public transit systems. Greg?
San Francisco is making, you know, part of this nice budgetary increase in the city is they can make some of the investments in public transportation, and those investments are happening. But you can't make an investment today that'll have an impact tomorrow. These investments take a long time.
Is your company doing anything specifically to help with this problem?
With the dislocation caused by, you know, some of the economic boom.
Yeah.
You know, as individuals, my partners and I all live in the city, and we contribute significantly to two causes in the city. Our biggest philanthropic causes are causes in the city, whether it's the hospitals or the schools. And I think that's true across the tech community. We've seen donations giving, philanthropic giving increase to the San Francisco public schools, to arts organizations in the city, et cetera. So the community, the tech community is a big and vital part of the city. We live here too, and we want to make San Francisco a better place for everybody. And so we're all working together to try to contribute, whether that's through our time and our volunteerism or through you know, our donations, when and where we can do that.
Aaron McElroy, finally back to you. What would you like to see happen this year that would really make a difference to help people who have lived in San Francisco or other cities like that for a long time and are now being priced out?
Yeah, well, first of all, while obviously San Francisco is becoming more affluent, it is important to note that the divide between the rich and the poor is growing faster than in any other city in the country currently. So we want to see that remedied. This is, in a lot of ways, an effect of a class war. We are seeing people who are poor and working class be squeezed out, while we are seeing people who are upwardly mobile bring in a lot of money, but not actually distribute it. We would like to see wealth more evenly distributed. And we aren't seeing a lot of these tech companies actually ask people in the community who are longtime residents what they actually want to see. We're actually seeing a lot of those decisions being made by higher-ups. Every Tuesday, the mayor meets with somebody in tech. We always say, why Tech Tuesdays and not Tenants Tuesdays?
Hmm.
We're very accessible. You know, none of us are hiding, are unavailable to talk to people who are actually interested in collaborating, but people aren't actually reaching out to us, and we ask them to.
Aaron, when you see the news that some tech company in the Bay Area has just raised $10 million, does that make you happy, or does that make you upset or nervous for the future, or what?
I mean, I think it depends what that company is and what they're planning on doing with that and how they actually interact with the community itself. I definitely don't see tech as a homogenous entity. I think obviously a lot of small startups are quite different than these large corporate behemoths. I have a lot more issue with Google and Apple and Facebook than I do a lot of the smaller tech startups.
Aaron McElroy of the group Eviction Free San Francisco. And we've also been talking with Greg Gretsch, managing director at the tech venture capital firm Sigma West. And we welcome your thoughts at hereandnow.org. Aaron and Greg, thanks to both of you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Robin, it's a topic that we're all impacted by if we live in cities especially, but we all know someone who's paying an arm and a leg for an apartment.
I know a couple who's renting one bedroom, a shared bath, one bedroom in a house in Berkeley for $1,300 a month.
Wow.
One bedroom.
Well, let us know how you're being impacted by gentrification and what you think of it at hereandnow.org. This is Here and Now.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and as you no doubt have picked up, it's marathon season. The iconic Boston Marathon is next Monday, but there are 10 other races in the next 6 days, one in Kentucky, another in New Mexico. And we want to take a few minutes now to talk about an interesting intersection of marathon season and Passover. This is the second day of the holiday remembering the Jewish exodus from slavery in Egypt. The connection? Well, observant runners have to forego the most basic staples of marathon training. Bagels, goo, that mushy sugar and electrolyte concoction, and the traditional pasta dinner. Rabbi Eli Glazer is, well, he's the perfect guest. He's an Orthodox rabbi, a marathon runner, and a nutritionist. He joins us from WYPR in Baltimore. And Rabbi, some know the story. Jews had to flee so quickly, they didn't have time to rise the bread, so eat leavened to commemorate that. But explain further, why can't observant Jews eat certain training foods on Passover?
Well, because on Passover, we're prohibited from having any grain products or any legume or any derivatives of legumes or grain products. And legumes really is a larger classification to include beans and corn and rice and anything that can be either harvested with grain products with wheat or has a similar appearance.
So you mentioned you can't eat any breads or pastas, any kind of grain, anything not certified kosher for Passover. How do you replace those?
Right. So that's a great question. So really what you're looking to do is to get electrolytes in your body, to get glucose, to build up your muscles, to avoid cramping, to avoid any type of fatigue. So therefore, you really want to make sure that you're consuming sodium, potassium, electrolytes, and you can certainly replace those without the normal foods or easy-to-use gels and goos that are marketed. In fact, I'm a natural nutritionist and also a marathon runner and Orthodox Jew. I train the whole year without any of those. Dates are a staple of my training, as well as bananas, and those are certainly kosher for Passover. And you want to make it, you know, mushy so it's not something you have to chew as you're trying to run. And you can crush dates and have almond slivers to get protein. And that's really a great fuel to use during a run or during training, as well as the electrolytes in your body. You can use smart water, which is nothing more than water with electrolytes added. And a lot of times people will take salt tablets to help their muscles fight fatigue. And I looked up and there's one called Salt Stick that ingredients don't have any of the prohibited kosher for Passover ingredients. So that's something, again, if someone would be training or be trying to recover from a run, could use. In addition, there are, you know, two kind of groups in the Jewish world called Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Sephardim are Jews from Spain or from North Africa or Middle Eastern countries. And Ashkenazi Jews are Jews primarily from European descent. And there are different customs that have evolved over the years. And one of the customs that Ashkenazim have is not to consume legumes or other types of products like that or the derivatives. However, someone from Sephardi descent have not adopted that custom. So they are actually able to eat rice and beans and corn. So therefore, the Sephardi runner would be able to avail himself or herself of more options during the holiday than an Ashkenazi runner would.
Yeah. One of the comments in the Runners World Forum is from someone who ran a marathon previously during Passover. This person does potatoes, matzah kugels.
Right. So that would be preparing beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
You want to make sure that your body really is hydrated and has a sufficient amount of carbohydrates that your muscles aren't lacking before the race. But the key part of carbing up is really during a race. It's called fueling, hydrating, and salting. And those have to be maintained during the race as opposed to really overloading as much before a race.
Rabbi Eli Glazer, sometimes called the Running Rabbi, in Baltimore, where he runs Soveya, an organization dedicated to promoting healthy eating and lifestyle. And happy Passover.
Thank you very much. And everyone, happy Passover to everyone in Boston and throughout the NPR world.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's Here and Now, and today the College Board, the company that oversees the SAT, released more details about the changes that are coming.
The College Board announced last month that it was going to overhaul the test, which has lost ground to its rival, the ACT. Among the key changes, words considered obscure will be replaced by words considered relevant. So instead of propinquity, which I know you will miss, Jeremy, a student might be asked to explain how the word intense is being used in a sentence.
Also, the essay on the test will be optional, and the top score will go back to the good old 1600 from the current 2400. Every test is going to include a passage from an original document like the Declaration of Independence, and there will no longer be an extra penalty for wrong answers. Ned Johnson is president of Prep Matters in Washington, D.C. He says the College Board is trying to make the SAT more relevant.
At the end of the day, if the test aligns more with what kids know in school, that has to be better for them. It aligns their interests more, it makes better use of their time. The biggest challenge with the changes to the SAT is that change creates uncertainty, creates unpredictability, and it just makes people really anxious. And stressed brains don't work well.
But many critics say the new test won't address the underlying problem with standardized tests. Bill Dingledean is an educational consultant in Greenville, South Carolina.
I really don't think it's going to change a whole lot because students and families who have a lot of money can pay to get additional testing, tutoring, schooling to prepare for the test. The original SAT was thought of as an aptitude test, and I think there are lots of skills and abilities that are not tested with the new test.
And again, these changes do not go into effect until 2016.
And by the way, tomorrow we're going to be talking to a college counselor, someone who helps high school students navigate the complex world of college admissions, which now can depend on demographics as much as your test scores. We want to hear from you and get your questions answered. You can send them to us at facebook.com/hereandnowradio, or you can go to hereandnow.org or send us a tweet at hereandnow.
By the way, propinquity, nearness in time, space, or kinship.
Use it in a sentence today. Well, for high school students that want a break from all the test taking, prom season is coming up, which means tuxes, gowns, and limousines, or if a limo is too stodgy, maybe a party bus. They carry more people. You can stand up and dance as you cruise down the road. But what about safety? Nationwide, there have been nearly 24 fatalities on these buses, and regulators say a crackdown on the industry is in order. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Austin Jenkins reports from Olympia, Washington.
If you've never been on a party bus before, let me take you inside one.
I'm William. This is my party bus.
William Prigmore is showing me his converted 1998 Ford shuttle bus. Picture neon lights, wraparound leather seats, and the center aisle converted into a narrow wood dance floor.
Got a nice stereo system with a PlayStation 2, 37-inch flat-screen TV, exotic pole.
Yes, this bus even has a brass pole. And no, it's not for holding onto around corners. I ask Prigmore, what's the point of a party bus?
The general concept is that people are paying a driver to drive them around so they can get intoxicated.
Sometimes the clients are going clubbing or it's an event like a bachelorette party. And then there are the kids.
We do proms and graduations. Of course, those kids don't drink.
He says with a smile. Actually, Prigmore tells me he's canceled a trip before because of underage drinking. But there's also a saying in this business, what happens on the party bus stays on the party bus. Prigmore says these parties on wheels have replaced the limo as the vehicle of choice for nights on the town. But as the industry gains popularity, regulators are scrambling to catch up. Dave Danner chairs Washington's Utilities and Transportation Commission. This state agency regulates in-state bus companies.
You've got a mix of alcohol, strobe lights, thumping party music, smoke machines, 4 tons of metal going down the road at 60 miles per hour. That's a cocktail for problems.
Danner says there's no way he would allow his own teenage daughter to ride on a party bus.
I would say no. I don't want her on a party bus.
And why is that?
Because I'm not convinced they're safe.
Danner notes the term party bus company doesn't even appear in Washington law, and there are loopholes companies can exploit to avoid regulation.
The fact of the matter is we don't know the universe of operators out there.
Now, so far, Washington has been spared the types of party bus tragedies that have happened elsewhere in the country.
We're learning more today about a young man who died after falling through the door of a party bus.
Killed after sticking his head out of an emergency hatch and hitting an overpass near the George Washington Bridge.
Killed after falling out of a party bus Friday night.
Investigators say the 26-year-old fell out of the back door of the Midnight Express party bus.
Washington's Utilities and Transportation Commission reports that over the past 4 years, there have been 21 fatalities nationwide. C.J. Saraceno from Watertown, Connecticut, was one of those fatalities. The graduate of Tufts University died in Los Angeles while celebrating a friend's birthday. According to police reports, CJ was standing up in front of the bus when it suddenly shifted. He fell against the passenger door. It opened and he tumbled out. CJ's father is Christopher Saraceno.
He was holding on for dear life as he's being dragged down the road in a jackknife position, hanging out the door. And the next thing you know, he got sucked under the tires and, you know, the rest of the story.
An investigation found the door wasn't working properly and the bus shouldn't have even been on the road that night. In another accident, 11-year-old Angie Hernandez died in Portland, Oregon, when a party bus emergency exit window popped open. Frank Langfitt is the attorney who represented the Hernandez family. He says an investigation found the bus was in poor mechanical condition and the driver and the bus company were not properly licensed.
There's a desperate need for regulation to protect the public, especially if you're going to have children on these buses.
California appears to be the only state with a specific party bus statute. Jim Hall is the former chair of the National Transportation Safety Board. He says regulators nationwide need to pay attention to this growing industry.
There have been enough accidents and fatalities, especially to young people, that there's plenty of grounds for local and state government to take appropriate action.
Back on board William Prigmore's bus, he expresses dismay that his industry is getting a bad rap.
This is keeping a lot of drunk drivers off of the road, or these party buses. This is something very positive.
Ultimately, Prigmore believes customers have to take some responsibility too. First, to check they're booking a properly licensed party bus, and to behave in a safe manner once they're on board. For Here and Now, I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia, Washington.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
It's Here and Now. Across the country this spring, there are people gathered in busy intersections and near downtown office buildings looking up with joy. They're watching birds of prey nest and their fledglings fly for the first time. A tremendous experience. But we have a cautionary tale. Back in 2010, we brought you the story of a glorious pair of red-tailed hawks nesting high on a glass-windowed office building outside Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Buzz and Ruby, yeah.
That's Ernie Cerro. He named the birds and started a blog to follow their exploits, of which there were many, like the time one of their offspring, Larry, flew, and fell to the busy street where he sat like a fire plug.
Hey, hey, hey. Look, what's that?
Yep, that's...
Is that the baby?
Yep, that's the youngest.
Let him go! Let him go!
Yeah, he may be stunned.
Oh, no.
Oh, come on. Oh, he's right in the street. This...
He survived.
Life is unfolding in front of you. I don't have to worry about this the way I have to worry about the oil leak in the Gulf. These are issues that are hard for me to face, and I don't see the way out of it. And then I look at something right here, right in front of us, unfolding right in front. It's life, it's nature in a very unnatural place.
Too unnatural. This past weekend, Ernie and others who could love Buzz and Ruby learned that Ruby's huge, lifeless body was discovered at the foot of the nest last week. It's thought this majestic bird of prey died after eating an animal contaminated by rat poison. Ruby's many fans are heartbroken, but they're also learning that across the country, this is not uncommon. We decided to call in Justine Lee. She's a veterinarian and toxicology expert in St. Paul, Minnesota. She joins us from Minnesota Public Radio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And, you know, a lot of people have their own personal anecdotes. I have one, a little Cocker Spaniel who got into a garage where some rat poison was stored and he died. You know, it's heartbreaking. But how widespread is this poisoning of, let's start with dogs and cats, by rat poison?
It's actually a huge problem. Unfortunately, most animal poison controls receive typically over 100,000 phone calls a year, with mouse and rat poisons being one of the top five poisons that dogs and sometimes cats get into.
Wow.
So it is a potentially life-threatening poisoning.
Well, and remind us, why? What is rat poison?
Well, there's actually four different types of mouse and rat poison that are readily available on the market. The most common type is something called an anticoagulant rodenticide, and that's the type that actually causes internal bleeding. Another type causes kidney failure, some other types cause seizures or tremors, and one type causes severe vomiting and even bloat. And the EPA in 2011 actually made this mandate where they're taking away the rodenticide or the mouse and rat poison that causes internal bleeding. Now, the type that Ruby got into, the red-tailed hawk, we suspect is an anticoagulant rodenticide. And unfortunately, it's what we call relay toxicity. When people put down mouse and rat poison, they mean to kill mice and rats, but unfortunately, dogs, cats, and wildlife end up getting into it, or they eat the dead mice and end up being poisoned secondarily.
Well, let's pick that up, because we've talked about pets. You have some more control over that, but you have no control over that food chain.
Absolutely. And that's why I'm a huge advocate of snap traps instead. There's no secondary relay poisoning that can affect wildlife.
Well, California has been a leader on this. California found that types of rat poison were responsible for the deaths of animals and at least 25 different wildlife species in California. Last month, that state passed a ban on the retail sale of many of these rat poisons. That ban, by the way, on a retail sale is being contested by a poison manufacturer. But that still means that large pest control companies are still putting it out.
That's correct. In fact, there's actually a lawsuit that's ongoing between some of the largest makers of mouse and rat poison against the EPA to change this mandate. So it is really frustrating. Right now, my general advice is if you care about wildlife, animals, pets, honestly, don't put mouse and rat poison out at all, just because it poses too much of a risk to both our two-legged and our four-legged and the wildlife out there.
Well, we both mentioned a company. It's Reckitt Benckiser, which makes the Decon line of retail rat poison. That's the company contesting both the EPA recommendations that rat poisons be banned in retail stores and California's ban. The company says that the agencies are end-running their own procedures, moving too quickly with these bans, and so there are legal actions there. But as you well know, Dr. Lee, other people might be thinking, well, what about the problems caused by rats? I mean, are the problems caused by rats enough to offset the concerns over wildlife?
That's a great concern. So, yes, mice and rats definitely harbor disease. So there are certain infections they can get or spread. And we remember that in the national park system where tularemia or plague were carried more recently. There are definitely public health risks when mice and rats live in the same environment as people. The biggest thing is really implementing appropriate environmental standards. So you can use mouse and rat poisons. You just have to make sure that you're using them judiciously. So putting them in an environment where a dog or a cat can't get into it. Ideally, I don't want them outside at all. So if you're going to use them, using them in the basement or in a locked garage or in a cupboard where mice and rats are getting into it, again, so there's no exposure to other animals.
Well, but then, you know, you may have and as we did recently on our street, you may have an animal inadvertently poisoned. It was a squirrel, but made its way to my backyard where I watched a cat eat it. It wasn't my cat, and later learned that that cat had become violently ill.
Yes, unfortunately, that's, again, what we call relay toxicity. And thankfully, dogs and cats are rarely poisoned by relay toxicity. And that's because 100% of their diet isn't off of wildlife. That's different for raptors or birds of prey. And they are severely affected by these anticoagulant rodenticides or different types of mouse and rat poison because they rely on 100% of their diet being comprised of mice or voles or things that can be poisoned. So again, while we want to ideally clean up the environment, make sure that we have food locked up, make sure we are preventing mice and rats from coming in and being exposed to people. Ideally, I hate to see the use of mouse and rat poisons just because of that secondary exposure to birds and wildlife.
Yeah, even though you recommend that the poison be in, let's say, a closed basement or a cupboard, if someone feels they have an infestation, they have to do it. That poisoned animal, whether it's a mouse or a rat, might get outside.
Absolutely. And that's the benefit of the snap trap. Even though people don't like using snap traps, they're actually much more humane. They instantly kill a mouse. They instantly kill a rat. And I'm actually of the philosophy that using these mouse and rat poisons is actually, in my opinion, inhumane to mice and rats, too. They slowly develop internal bleeding. They slowly develop acute kidney failure. They seizure. And so it's not a humane way for even wildlife to pass away.
The environmental group Earth Justice says the same thing. They are against the poisons, even on rats. But certainly nobody wanted to see a glorious animal like a hawk die from poisoning.
It's such a shame. And honestly, it's so prevalent. And I'm glad that this actually increased the awareness because we see it all the time. We actually even see it in larger cats, bobcats, anything that is preying on wildlife. So again, the best thing that people can do is avoid the use of mouse and rat poison just because it can contaminate both the environment and also expose our pets to it.
Justine Lee, a veterinarian and toxicology expert in St. Paul, Minnesota. She's also creator of the podcast Vet Girl. We'll have that at hearandnow.org. Justine, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on the show, Robin.
And Jeremy, we started with the story of Ruby, the red-tailed hawk.
Yeah.
I wish you could have seen her. And people who love that bird are going to try to organize area businesses to stop putting out poisons. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.